If you'll read Isaiah chapter 7, where the prophecy commences, this was given in the days of Ahaz, about 742 B.C. Now, this Ahaz was king of Jerusalem, and Isaiah was there. And in verse 10 it says, "The Lord spake again unto Ahaz, saying, Ask you a sign of the Lord thy God, ask it either in the depth or in the height above, anything. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Lord." And then he goes on to say, "Well, the Lord himself will give you a sign. A virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel." Then it gives a history of this Emmanuel, right on up until this Emmanuel becomes 2 years of age, then older, and then finally becomes king. And then he fights against an Assyrian force at the end of the age, and universal peace and prosperity appears on the earth. That's one long prophecy, Isaiah 7 through 12. Okay? Now, near the end of the age, though, when this Emmanuel then becomes grown and he's going to be here in power and glory, the Assyrians are going to assemble up north here, and they're going to make a final onslaught toward Jerusalem. It's the same battle that Zechariah was talking about when he says the time when they will surround Jerusalem. Now, let's pick up the story, though, of this final battle in, let me see if I can get it here, chapter 10 and verse 28. This is where Isaiah picks up the final battle that's going to take place at Jerusalem. Now, mind you, up at Armageddon where we were is where the nations will gather, and then one arm will go of the armed forces down the coast and go around Jerusalem to the south near Arad, south of that even, and then go down into the Valley of Decision near the Dead Sea. Another arm will go to the pass of the Jezreel east of Armageddon, and go down the Araba, that is the Jordan. And another one will come down the central area here, which we're on. And that will be led by the Assyrian himself, the commander of this force. Now, this has never happened in history. Never has happened in history. We have no record whatsoever that this battle that is being talked of here has ever happened. And it occurs right at the time that Emmanuel becomes the king over all the earth. That means Christ becomes king over the earth. That's clear, as we're going to read in just a moment. But about this Assyrian leading this army, Isaiah picks it up by saying in verse 28 of chapter 10, Isaiah 10, 28, "He, the Assyrian, is come to Ai," Aiath, that's the feminine for Ai, the city of Ai. Now, I am going to show you in about 30 minutes where Ai is, okay? Ai. It's about 4 miles north of here. Isaiah picks up the movement of this Assyrian with his army coming toward Jerusalem at Ai, north of us about 4 miles, which would be north of Jerusalem about 10 miles. So he says in verse 28, if you want to follow me, you may, in your Bibles. Verse 28, "He is come to Ai. He is passed to Migron. At Michmash, he has laid up his carriages." That's this Assyrian king. Now, we were just back here at Michmash, weren't we? Okay? He's going to lay up his carriages at Michmash. By laying up his carriages, it means he's going to gather his army. They're coming from Armageddon area. They're going to bivouac in this area. Now, the reason they're going to stop here first is because there's a steep valley, the one we see in front of us here, called the Passage of Michmash, and he is heading southward. Obviously, he is going to go on the plateau area up there too, but specifically, Isaiah says he will lay up his carriages here at Michmash. And again, I must emphasize, this has never happened in history. This can only be for the end of the age, and in my view, not many years hence. So get a view of this area, and this prophecy, I tell you, it's talking about this very region. It's not talking about London, England. It's not talking about Mount Poconos in Pennsylvania, like some of us may have thought. You know what I mean, the past. It's talking about here, because the very hills and valleys and towns of this region are being discussed. And the Jerusalem that's going to be invaded, or trying to be invaded by this Assyrian king, is right down there south of us. It's not in place else. Okay, then he lays up his carriages at Michmash. But then what does he do? They are gone over the passage. They are taken up their lodging at Geba. Now what they do, after they lay up here, they get everything ready, and then it says they go over the passage and they take up residence or lodging at Geba. Where is Geba? Right back up there on your left, where we were. Okay? You know what Isaiah is talking about here? He's saying this is the passage. Now here we are at this very spot, standing in the passage between Michmash and Geba. Okay? This is Isaiah 10. Now, he goes to Geba. Now listen to this. Ramah is afraid. That's up on the hill there, you see? And a little farther beyond. Ramah is afraid. They're getting farther south. The next one is verse 29. Gibeah of Saul is fled. So by this time, he now has taken over Geba. He's taken over Ramah. He's going southward. Now he's at Gibeah, where King Hussein's palace was. But that he doesn't stop there. Then he says, verse 30, lift up your voice, O daughter of Galim. Galim is an unidentified area, but just toward the south a little bit, toward Jerusalem. Cause it to be heard in Laish. No one knows exactly where Laish is, but look at the last verse. Last part of verse 30. O poor Anathoth. You see, that is where Jeremiah was born, some 100 years after Isaiah wrote this. But Anathoth was that village I showed you where the minaret was a few minutes ago. All right, now he's going farther toward Jerusalem. See the point? From Ai writhe through this way, he's going farther southward. And that's exactly what Isaiah is talking about. Madmina is removed, another little town. The inhabitants of Gibeon gather themselves to flee. That's a little farther toward Jerusalem, getting real close to it. Now, look at this. We come to verse 32. I told you to remember that when we left Jerusalem, I said, remember this spot, it's called Nob. It was an ancient priestly city where many of the priests of the temple lived. When you get to Nob, it's the first time that you're able to look south and see Jerusalem. You'll see there the great temple that was there back in Isaiah's time. So it says in verse 32, as yet shall he remain at Nob. So he reaches Nob, this Assyrian, with his great army. He reaches Nob that day. That day. It takes one day from here to get to Nob. And that's all it takes. Now, what does he do when he gets to Nob, this Assyrian? He shall shake his hand against the mount of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. So there is where he expresses his defiance against the city of Jerusalem, this Assyrian. And by the way, if you want to know who the Assyrian is and about his army, read the first part of chapter 10 and all of chapter 9 of Isaiah, because this is all one long prophecy. While you're here, if you really want to learn about this, start with chapter 7, go all the way to chapter 12, and you'll get the whole scenario of what's being talked about. So he gets to Nob. It takes one day for him to leave Michmash, go over the passage right here, go to Geba, Ramah, Gibeah, Anathoth, Nob. When he gets there, he shakes his hand against the mount of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Now look at what happens in verse 33. Behold, the Lord of hosts, shall lop the bough with terror, and the high ones of stature shall be hewn down, and the haughty shall be humbled. And he shall cut down the thickets of the forest with the iron, and Lebanon shall fall by a mighty one. Now this verse 33 and 34 is giving symbolic teaching here about the Assyrian and his army as being like trees, like thickets. And the Assyrian himself, all commentators by the way know this, the Assyrian himself is called the Lebanon. He's like a Lebanese cedar, a large cedar. And his army are trees. His army represents thickets. And you know what's going to happen? They shall lop the bough with terror. The high ones of stature shall be hewn down like trees. The haughty shall be humbled. And he shall cut down the thickets of the forest, that means his army, with iron. And Lebanon himself, that is the great cedar, that is the Assyrian, shall fall by a mighty one. Now, who is the mighty one that will destroy this Lebanon, this cedar of Lebanon, this Assyrian, when he reaches Nob down there and begins to show defiance against Jerusalem? Well, forget all about the chapter indications here. They're completely modern. They didn't even come into existence until the 14th century A.D. But you go right on with the prophecy. You know who the mighty one is that will be in Jerusalem at this time? The one who was introduced back in chapter 7 at the beginning of the prophecy. His name is Emmanuel. And you know who this Emmanuel is? He's a son of David. But he's also something else. He is called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. He is the one of the increase of his government and peace. There shall be no end upon the throne of David. Who is the Mighty One? Well, read verse 1 of chapter 11. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom, understanding, Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity of the meek of the earth. He shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay, now notice this, the wicked one. Who is the wicked one? He is this Lebanon mentioned here. He is the Assyrian mentioned in verse 24. He is the one who comes against Christ, or the son of David, of Jesse, at this end time, when he lifts his fist and hand against Jerusalem. This wicked one here, where it says, with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked one. In the New Testament, do you know that verse is absolutely quoted dealing with the second coming of Christ? Let me give it to you. 2 Thessalonians, I beg your pardon. Chapter 2, it takes me a minute to get to it here. Paul quoted this very scripture and this very battle that we're talking about here in the New Testament. And again, I say, most people just passed right over it. I did years ago myself. So I'm not condemning anyone for passing over these things, but we've got to pay close attention to them. And here we are in this very passage of Michmash, dealing with this one day that will start from this war or the movement to Jerusalem from here, Michmash to Jerusalem in one day. Now we come to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and it says, verse 1, now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by or about our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind, nor be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter as from us, as that the day of Christ is at hand, that is present. He was talking back there some 2,000 years ago, 1900. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come the falling away, as it is in the Greek, the falling away first, that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sits in the temple of God, showing himself to be God. This man will establish himself down there in Jerusalem, but he will leave Jerusalem to go to the north and east, so the book of Daniel says, and then come back with this army to re-attack Jerusalem. Again, you have to put the whole story together. Remember you not, Paul says, verse 5, that when I was yet with you, I told you these things, and now you know what withholds, that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity does already work. Only he who now lets or restrains will let, until he be taken out of the way. Now look at this verse 8. And then shall that wicked, or that wicked one, be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth. That's an absolute quote from Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 4 that we just were looking at. And shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming, parousia, is after the working of Satan with all powers and signs and lying wonders, and all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie, in the Greek is the lie, that they might be damned or judged who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. In other words, the Apostle Paul saw this event when Christ would come at his coming and consume this wicked one with the spirit of his mouth. He looked upon it as associated with the second coming. Go back again to Isaiah, and we'll close on it in just a moment here. Isaiah, let me turn to it once more, right back to that section in chapter 11, and here's what it says. Verse 4, but with righteousness shall this son of Jesse, this Emmanuel, he shall judge the poor, reprove with equity of the meek of the earth. He shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. Now look at the verse. And with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked one. So the Apostle Paul then brings this in with the second coming, and indeed that's the case. But here is the passage in front of us that Isaiah was talking about, and he will then in one day's time, it only takes one day for him to go from here to Geba, to Ramah, to Gibeon, to Anathoth, to Nob, and to his destruction. Okay? Let's go on. The point that we need to make is that this end time prophecy here can only be understood by the geography that we have here. You can't transport all of this somewhere over to Great Britain or to the United States. See the point?
Yeah.
It's got to be right here. Because there's Geba right up there, and there's Michmash right there. And we're right now in the passage. Get a good look at it, because there's going to be a whole army coming this way in the few years ahead of us, according to the scripture.
Curtis,
yes, sir.
Where are they coming from?
They're coming from the north. They're coming from Armageddon. They're coming down the central area through Samaria. And Isaiah here, as I said, picks up their final battle against... Oh, I'm sorry. We needed to go that way. Never mind. Now here's Geba. See again? Right up there. And you can get a good look at Michmash over on the left. You know, in one way of looking at it, if you look at that prophecy from chapter 7 to 12 of Isaiah, it's just pay close attention. And really, you know who's guiding us through this area here? It's not Ernest Martin. It's Isaiah the prophet. See the point?
Yeah.
There's Michmash. Why does the Assyrian want Jerusalem? He had been there for almost three and a half years. And remember, he hears tidings from the east and the north. It says in the book of Daniel, and he goes up to destroy many. Then he comes back to establish his palace between the glorious seas. He is coming to finally make Jerusalem the capital of the world in which he is going to rule. Prophecies show that during the millennium and for, well, the next 1,000 years, Jerusalem is going to be the capital. There's Geba on the other side there on the right. Anathoth back over here on the left. See it there where the minaret is? That's Anathoth. And he is coming to establish the Messianic kingdom. It's called the false Messianic kingdom or the Antichrist kingdom. He's going to look like Christ, this man is. Lots of people are going to think that he is Christ. And they're going to... In actual fact, what they're going to do, the deception is going to be so complete, they're going to think that the two witnesses mentioned in the 11th chapter of the book of Revelation, they're going to think that they are the beast and the false prophet. And they're going to think that the beast and the false prophet are the two witnesses. They're going to think that the false prophet is the true Elijah to come. In actual fact, he's the false Elijah. They're going to think of the beast as being the true Christ, when in actual fact it's going to be the false Christ. And it's going to be so cleverly done that Christ said in Matthew 24 that even the apostles themselves, the very elect, would be close to believing it if they didn't know better. It's going to look good. But you got to keep all of these prophecies in mind. I'll tell you one thing, if you want my own opinion, I'm not going to accept anyone as the Christ, at least I don't think I will. Unless someone gives me a pill or something like that. I'm not going to believe anyone is Christ until I see the Mount of Olives split in two. I mean any man. Now we'll go up here to the main road and turn right to Bethim, which is the modern name for Bethel. There are a few things up there I want to show you. We won't stay too long because we must hurry right along here. Got some interesting things to tell you about Gibeon in a little later. Yes, this is the place. We're going to get out of the coach and walk over about 100 yards. So let's stay together, and we have to be quick. But I do want to show you this place. This is the area of Bethel. There were two Bethels, Upper and Lower Bethel. The ruins you see here of this building is that they are of a Byzantine church. And remember, Byzantine is from the time of Constantine the Great, 325 AD up to around 620 AD. This is the site of Bethel. It's most important because of the early history of Jacob and of even of Abraham. Abraham came here, and it says that he raised up an altar between Bethel, right here, and Ai, which is right beyond this. You see that rocky mountain there in the distance, about a mile? Ai is just beyond that, and there's a little hill there. The word Ai means ruin, and even Joshua at the time was the one who ruined it, and it hasn't been built up at any time since. But it was even, no, Ai is a later name for it, is what I mean. But still, it's the same. When the book of Genesis was written, it was written at a later time to explain how things were, the geographical region, so people could understand it. Here we are at a place, it says, where Abraham pitched and made an altar. And between Ai and Bethel, it would probably be up at that rocky knoll there. I've been up there several times, too far to go for us to walk up there. But certainly, this is the region of Bethel. Why is it important? Well, it says in the book of Genesis that Jacob, on his way to Mesopotamia, came to this area here, and he found that it was in ruins. A town was here, was in ruins even at that time. It was called Luz, L-U-Z. And while here, he got sleepy, and he lay down, and he picked a pillow for a pillow, a pillar, you know, a pillar stone. Now, the stone that he picked was from a building of some kind. You see, even this ruin up here, obviously this is a Byzantine church, but because it's in ruins, it does give an idea of what Jacob found when he came here. Now, he found a ruined city, and so he takes one of the blocks that made up the city wall or house or something, and he put it down for his head. And then he slept on that. While he slept, you remember that he saw a ladder going into heaven, and then angels descending and ascending into heaven. Now that's most interesting, because, you know, from this spot right here, it would mean that this is a jumping off place, you might say, to heaven. Not over on some other mountain, but, you know, here. You can go up and down the ladder to heaven. And so when he saw that, and he saw the significance of it, he then named this place Bethel, meaning house of God, God's house. And he never forgot that vision that he saw, never forgot it. He carried on from here and went on up to Mesopotamia, and there is where he got his two wives. You know, he had to work for Leah, then he had to work for Rachel, and he had 11 children up there. Then he came back down this area here, and Rachel was big with child, about to be give birth to Benjamin, which happened just a little while after he came back to this area. When he got to this area here, his name was changed from Jacob, which means supplanter, to Israel, meaning Prince of God. And it's right after this that he met his, around this time, he had met his brother Esau, and they'd made a reconciliation and things like that. So the name Israel starts from this spot right here. And this is where the vision was seen of the angels going forth, back and forth in heaven. By the way, I just might mention this to you. You've all heard of the medieval story, Jack and the Beanstalk, haven't you? They used to tell stories, you know. A lot of people were so illiterate they couldn't read, and people would some of these storytellers would go through the ancient town, early towns of Europe, and they'd tell this story and that story, and before you know it, they'd add a little bit here and a little there, you know, and so forth. Before you know it, Jack and the beanstalk. The ladder turns into a beanstalk, and Jack is Jacob, of course. Instead of angels, you know, going up, what do they find? A giant up there. The giant is God. And what does the giant say? Fee, fi, fo, fum, something like that. Oh, well, an Englishman got it on our side.
Yeah.
On France, they had another one, I think. But the thing is, fee, fi, fo, fum, 1, 2, 3, 4, the tetragrammaton, God. See, fee, fi, fo, fum, the vowel. Just put the take the F out, and what you got is Yahweh there. Yeah. The whole thing. It's all mixed up. But many of our fairy tales, like Cinderella, same thing. That's another story, though. But right here is the region where Jacob saw that ladder going into heaven and coming back. And it was called Bethel. Now, after that, we find that later on, when the kingdom of Solomon broke up, and Jeroboam took the northern 10 tribes, and Rehoboam took the southern 2, or 3, if you want to call them that, they kept Jerusalem as the headquarters down there for Judah. And Geba then became the border, you know, between Judah in the south, and then the northern kingdom known as Samaria. Well, what did Jeroboam do? Because the people were religious, obviously, somewhat. He raised up two shrines. One of them he put way up in Dan, where we were, you know, the other day at the River Jordan, and the other he placed here. We have not found the one here. We found the one up there. The altar and all that is gone. But he put a shrine here and put up a bull, you know, the calf, here at Bethel. He got as close to Jerusalem as he could, you see, to be a rival temple to Jerusalem. Of course, Bethel was destroyed not long after that, and it didn't amount to much. And after the time of Jeremiah, you never hear of it anymore. It just goes by the wayside. And the only thing is about the Byzantines, they knew that this was the general region, and the little town that's here is called Betin. Betin is Arabic, but it's very, very close to Bethel, and certainly this is the general region of Bethel. Now, there's another reason why this is important. It says that when Abraham and Lot came back from Egypt, that they had great herds, and the herdsmen of both of them were getting into arguments because they were getting in the way of each other. And you remember that Abraham said to Lot, his nephew, he says, Lot, he says, the whole land is ours. It's in front of us, you know. He said, you look northward, you look southward, you look eastward, you look westward, and whatever part of the land you want, you go. And you stay there, and I'll take the rest. He gave him first choice. Now, it's most interesting. Where is Sodom and Gomorrah, you see? Where is it? Well, here's the thing. If you'll read it very carefully, they were at Bethel when that decision came up. They were here in this region. That's why it's most important to realize that. And you know what the Bible says? And I don't know why in the world some of these ancient scholars even didn't see this. I don't know. But it says that Lot looked over, you can't see it too well now, the well-watered plains of Jordan, you know, the plains of Sidon down there. And he said, that's where I'm going. And so he went down to Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember over here when we were talking at Geba about the wilderness of Zeboam, and I said was to the east? Zeboam was one of those towns. And the town down there gave name to the wilderness area up here. You see, I mean, coming up the slope. So Zeboam, Sodom, Gomorrah, and Admah, and Zoar were down in the northern area, not down there in the south. I didn't say one word yesterday when John was saying this is Sodom, you know, the place. No need to, because that goes back to the first century, that tradition. But in no way could they be down there. They're in the northern region up here. And it seems like that Sodom and Gomorrah themselves are underneath the northern edge of the Dead Sea, because it says that in a little parenthesis there, as the King James has it, and this should be in the Bible, that the area where those cities were are now the Salt Sea. The Salt Sea. So it's the northern edge, you see, where those cities were. It's important to realize that where those areas were, simply because, I mean, you can identify them pretty easily and show how tradition is so wrong to put them in the south. The only reason they did is because in ancient times they knew that that southern area was very shallow. And they could look down in there on a clear day and see the ruins of villages. That's true. But just because you see the ruins of villages down there does not mean that they're Sodom and Gomorrah, you see. So from here, and in fact, if you got up on the ridge over there, where no doubt Abraham pitched his tent, made an altar, it almost has to be the place, not here, because it was between Bethel and Ai, it says. If you get up there, you can see down to the River Jordan on a clear day, easily. So this area here is the region that that Jacob's name was changed to Israel. This is the place where Israel had its beginning, right here. And in earlier times, they said, well, why in the world pick Jerusalem, you know, for the temple? And even the Samaritans thought it was crazy to have it in Jerusalem, which was 500 years after the time of Moses, you see, almost, when David got that down there. But David did it under inspiration. Most people say, oh, no, it's better to have it up here. This is where the ladder was going to heaven in the first place, you know. Well, God didn't select this place, though it was known as Bethel. Okay, now we're on our way to El-Jeb, otherwise known as Gibeon, where the sun stood still. Okay? See that village up there on that mountain? That is Gibeon. It's called El-Jeb to this very day. Now, this gives you an idea of how ancient sites can be discovered by modern names. That name El-Jeb has been there for the last 1,500 years on that. Since the Mohammedan invasion, about 1,300 years. But El-Jeb is Gibeon, same thing. And we're going to go beyond it a little bit and then come back to it. We'll go up there and then walk to the top of the area, and there's a tell up there, a small one, on top of that mountain. And once we get up there, I'll open up the Bible in a few places. You'll find it very, very interesting, I think. I just noticed this high place, and I like to get on the high place. I can sit down. You can in a minute, too. But this is a most important place. This is El-Jeb, or Gibeon. It was excavated about 30 years ago, and up on the trench, they had trenches all over this main area here, and they found pottery with even Gibeon in ancient Hebrew on it. So you see, there's no problem in identifying it. And besides that, they found many, many wine potsherds and things like that, or pots that would and jars that would hold wine. And over there, where you saw the holes in the rock, that was really for wine storage, so that the wine would mature, you know, in a cool place. This, however, is a water cistern, and carved out of the solid rock. What they would do is collect rainfall. They had a series of a watershed here, where a series of little canals that they would bring the water into this area here. Also, there is a spring out here, just about 100 yards, a little over 100 yards from here, a spring. And what they did, too, was to, at dry seasons, they dug down as far as they could, and then they had a tunnel that would go out to that spring, and they would enclose it. So there's a tunnel under here about 100 yards long to that. And all of this was done in many, many hundreds of years before the time of Christ. This cistern right here has to go back to the earliest period of Gibeon, and it's mentioned in the Bible on two different occasions, and I'm going to show it to you right in just a few minutes. But before we talk about the cistern, there were a number of things that happened here at this Gibeon. Most interesting, you remember at the conquest of the land of Palestine by Joshua, he had sent up his forces from Gilgal, which is opposite Jericho, and Jericho had been destroyed by the great earthquake, so they couldn't live there. They didn't want to live there. But from Gilgal, where Joshua had his headquarters down there, they came up the pass of Michmash, which we saw. And they would then spread out and conquer certain towns. We have in the Bible, in the book of Joshua, about the conquering of Ai. I mentioned that, you know, not far from where we were over there at Bethel. But they were having trouble getting this central area. And if you'll read let me see if I can turn to it very quickly here. In Joshua, getting in a minute, in the earlier section, Joshua chapter 10 is where, this is about where the sun and the moon stood still at that great battle. The king of the Amorites, who was Adonizedek, He at the time was seeing that Joshua was almost invincible. So what he did was to get five of his own kings, Amorite kings, together, and they were going to have a major battle against Joshua. So what they did was to come up into this area here, and Joshua heard about it. Now, he was still down at Gilgal. But then it says here in chapter 10 and verse 8 of Joshua, and the Lord said unto Joshua, fear them not. These five kings had come together with a great force. For I have delivered them into your hand. There shall not a man of them stand before you. And Joshua, therefore, came up unto them, or came unto them suddenly, and went up from Gilgal all night. He went up from Gilgal. You notice how it says went up from Gilgal? If Gilgal's down there in Jordan, he came up here. It took him all night with his army. So he gets up here. And the Lord discomforted them, that is the Canaanites, before Israel, and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon. Right here, at Gibeon. And chased them along the way that goeth toward Beth Horon. That way, toward the pass Beth Horon. And smote them to Azekah, and unto Makkadah, which is right up here on the bluff area, just before you start down the pass. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel, and were in the going down to Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down great stones from heaven upon them. Now, it means hailstones. Great hailstones coming down from heaven. And they died. They were more which died with hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. And then spake Joshua to the Lord in that day, when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, because they had come up all night, had the battle during the daytime, and then nightfall was just about to come, and they hadn't finished them off yet. And there was still hail coming down. But it says that Joshua said, son, stand you still upon Gibeon, and you moon in the valley of Ajalon, stand still. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is this not written, says the author of Joshua, in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. About a whole day. Almost 24 hours. Not quite. You know why it couldn't go beyond 24 hours? Because there's a promise back here given to Noah that day and night will be the same from now on. You know. So you got to have...
And that promise made to Noah is most instructive even for us today. And certainly to interpret what was happening back there in the time of Joshua's long day, as it's called. You remember back in Genesis chapter 8 and verse 22, it says, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. This means that the world would always be guaranteed their days, that is the length of days as far as the astronomical heavens were concerned, the sun and the moon. And their nights also would be in proper harmonious motions. Christ gave the universal understanding that there are, on the average, 12 hours in each day, John 11, verse 9. And this means, of necessity, that there are also 12 hours of night. This means that God, in order to keep the promise made to Noah right after the flood, that there would be no more any major disturbances, that is, that would last more than a day, that there would be day and night, that sometime during the day, 24-hour day, I mean, there would have to be a night period in the temperate zones of the earth, of course, where Palestine is located. Now, in actual fact, there are teachings in the Bible that the heavens, the sun and the moon in particular, and all the motions of the heavens would stay in a standard way, in a harmonious way, until the creation of a new heavens and a new earth, which is prophesied in Isaiah 65 and verse 17, and of course, Revelation 21, 1. And if that is true, in fact, let's just read that. In Psalm 89, verses 34 and 37, it says, my covenant will I not break, nor alter the thing that has gone out of my lips. his seed, it means the seed of David, shall endure forever, for the age. And his throne as the sun before me, it shall be established as the moon, and as a faithful witness in heaven. And that's unquote. Now Jeremiah, in the last part of the 7th century B.C., also recalled the constancy of the motions of the sun and the moon and stars. That means in their physical sense. That's what we're talking about now. He said in Jeremiah 31, verses 35 and 36, "Thus saith the Lord," this is Yahweh speaking, "which gives the sun for the light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and the stars for a light by night. If those ordinances depart from before me, says the Lord, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me." Now, this means that the physical moon and the physical sun and the stars will remain in a constancy, a permanence, as far as their motions are in the heavens. Now, this was from the time of David here in Psalm 89, of course, and from the time of Jeremiah, 7th century, last part of the 7th century B.C., as far as Jeremiah is concerned. But God told Noah that there would be a constancy to day and night. Now, with all of this in the Bible, it would show that the sun and the moon and actually did carry on in their normal orbits. But my goodness, when you look at what is happening here in Gibeon, you find that the sun appeared to stand still, and so did the moon. How in the world can that be explained? What we find from Jeremiah, though, and what David said, there's a permanence and a consistency to the motions of the heavenly bodies. But what about this sun standing still for almost a whole day in Joshua's time that we're referring to here? And I also might add that in the time of Isaiah, there was the sundial of Ahaz that went backwards by 10 degrees or by 10 steps. And that's in Isaiah 38, verses 1 through 8. Well, how did these things occur? It may come as a surprise to some of us today, but it can be shown from the Holy Scriptures themselves that the motions of the sun and the moon were in no way altered on those two occasions, and I mean Joshua's long day that we're talking about now. Though at first glance it may seem almost certain that they were. The fact that they could not have been altered because of the promise given to mankind at the time of Noah, that the heavenly bodies which give our days and nights and seasons of the years in their proper sequences, God told Noah they would remain in their same motions until the creation of the new heavens and new earth at a much future time, Isaiah 65:17 and Revelation 21, verse 1. But did God violate his own promise to mankind when the sun and moon appeared to stand still for almost a whole day in the time of Joshua, and when the sundial of Ahaz returned in its shadow some 10 degrees? The fact is, God did not disturb the motions of the sun or the moon. That is, the actual physical motions. Even Jeremiah and the psalmist, as I said before, were aware that the ordinances of God regarding the movements of the sun, moon, and stars had remained constant and undisturbed. Now, if this is the case, then what happened at what is called Joshua's long day and with the sundial of Ahaz? Really, it's not difficult to discover it if we pay attention to the biblical revelation itself. You see, the Bible can interpret itself, and this is where it's most important that we take into consideration all of the biblical teaching on these matters so that we can comprehend what God is actually talking about in these matters. First, let it be understood that God could stop the motions of the sun and the moon, or cause the sun to return backwards if he wished. Matthew 19:26 makes that absolutely clear, and I wouldn't argue the matter with anyone. I mean, I know that God has the power to do it. But the reason we're here, the reason ASK is here, why I am trying to give out teaching from God as best I can through education and all that, is to find out really what God means in the scripture when he says what he does. What is at stake are God's covenants, though, and promises made to Noah and to all mankind of the future that these motions were to remain in a permanent way, in a consistency, and a constancy, as a matter of fact. And when the psalmist and Jeremiah make these promises, well, I think that we ought to pay attention to them. In no way will God violate his promises or covenants that he's made with mankind. But what did happen at those two times in history when it appears on the surface that God did indeed alter the motions of the sun and the moon? And this is certainly the case here at Gibeon, where we find the book of Jasher that was being quoted stated without doubt that the sun appeared to stand still over Gibeon and the moon appeared to stand still for almost a 24-hour period over Ajalon. Well, the matter really is explained. Now, how this happened, the matter is explained precisely in Isaiah 60, verses 19 and 20. And it's remarkable that many of us have overlooked these important scriptures in the past. Let us notice what Isaiah says about these matters concerning the heavenly bodies. Quote, "The sun shall be no more your light by day." And this is coming in the future, but it deals with the sun here. "Neither for brightness shall the moon give light to you. But the Lord," that means Yahweh himself, "shall be with you as an everlasting," that is an age-lasting light, a light that lasts a long, long time. "And your God shall be your glory. Your sun," Isaiah says, "shall no more go down, neither shall your moon withdraw itself. For the Lord shall be your everlasting or age-lasting light, and the days of your mourning," he says to Israel, "shall be ended," unquote. Now these verses in Isaiah 60, verses 19 and 20, they tell us in no uncertain terms that God himself shall become our light and our glory, which means he will be like the sun in its strength. This means that our sun and our moon will be the glory of God, shining forth in his supreme light. Isaiah is describing what the Jews call the Shekinah, that is, the glory of God, that type of glory that existed in over the tabernacle as a cloud during the daytime in the Exodus period and also as a bright light at night. And it's called the Shekinah. And it, for a full explanation of how this was done, send for the expositor, which I've written on this subject, called the Astronomical Principles of the Bible. And in there you will find that all of the details of how this was accomplished are given in literature form. And I think you will find it very interesting. And in the future, prophecy says there will be a Palestinian state. Psalm 83, I believe, makes that very clear, and there are other prophecies that show that. There will be a Palestinian state in the Middle East, but though they would like to have the West Bank, where there's a beautiful territory to be had, though they were routed in the past, so will they be in the future. I do not believe that there will be any, initially there could be, but not by the time of the second coming of Christ. There's going to be a Palestine state, a Philistine state, and it will be down where the Philistines were always, in the area near Gaza, and that is no doubt where it will be. What we notice from the geography and history around Jerusalem here of the past mentioned in the Bible is really a teaching for us of the future if we will look at it. Now, I don't mean everything will be precisely done again in cycle form, but we need to look at these prophecies and also these geographical indications and understand that God is very much in action. He is the one in control of all the destinies of the nations, and he certainly is of the nation of Israel. We've got to keep our eyes on this part of the world. It is the nation of Israel and Jerusalem, which happens to be the center of all prophecy. Let's keep our eyes on this area here, and I think we will understand prophecy and the near future just to us as never before. Have that area.